The Philanthropy for Voice of San Diego. We are so happy to be here with you today. If you don't know us, Voice of San Diego is a nonprofit investigative news organization committed to holding public officials accountable and giving you, the public, the information you need to be advocates for good government. As a nonprofit, we depend on members, donors, and sponsors like you to make our work possible. So thank you for your support. I'd like to take a minute to recognize our sponsors who help make PolitiFest possible. A special thanks to the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of San Diego for being our partner for a seventh year. Our thanks also to the Sequon Band of the Kumeyaay Nation, the United Domestic Workers Union, AARP, the San Diego Foundation, Business for Good, Hitsky Development, the San Diego Municipal Employees Association, the Asian Business Association, Planned Parenthood of the Pacific Southwest, Atlantis Group, and the Southern California Rental Housing Association. We'd also like to thank KPBS and iNewsSource, our partners in public matters. We are partnering together to share content, conversation, and events like PolitiFest to ensure all San Diegans understand their opportunity to participate in the democratic process and that it means more than voting in an election. A couple of logistical things for PolitiFest. If you can attend any of our sessions in person, we will have the recordings up on our website next week. We welcome your questions. We'll have two volunteers, one on each side, who have note cards and pens for you to write down questions. If you have a question that you'd like to write down, just raise your hand and they'll bring it to you. And then when you're done writing it, raise your hand again and they will collect it. And we will have that during our question and answer portion. You can tweet along with us and with this session by using the hashtag PolitiFest2024 on social media and tag us on Instagram and Facebook. Now allow me to introduce our moderator, Andrea Lopez Villafana, who is our managing editor at Voice of San Diego.
Thank you, Erica. Hi, how's everyone doing? All right, I will speak loudly. If you can't hear me, let me know. I am super jittery from all the coffee I've had. This always happens at PolitiFest. Just let me know if you can't hear me, but I should be pretty loud because I got all the caffeine in me. We're going to have a great discussion, debate here, I think. I sat in the middle just in case it gets a little wild, but I think we'll be fine. Let me introduce to you your candidates for the District 9 City Council race. On my left is Sean Elo Rivera. He's currently represents the district. He was elected in 2020 and has served as the City Council President since 2021. Thanks for coming, Sean. Awesome. And then to my right is Terry Hoskins. He is a retired police officer and sergeant major with the Marine Corps. If elected, this would be his first time in office. So welcome, Terry. Awesome. Let me just make sure your mics are on. Good. Okay. So we're doing something new with PolitiFest this year. We're setting up a little primer. But since this is a debate, I'm not going to get too into the primer. If you already are familiar with District 9, you know what neighborhoods are in it, you know top issues. So I'll speed past that. But I may, throughout the course of the debate, interrupt our panelists and have them explain a term they might have mentioned. So we'll just do that. Of course, District 9 includes the communities of Alvarado Estates, City Heights, College Area, College View Estates, El Cerrito, Kensington, Mission Valley East, Mountain View, Mount Hope, Normal Heights, Redwood Village, Rolando Park, Rolando Village, Stockton, and Talmadge. Did I miss any? Sounds right. Cool. It's an incredibly diverse district. I had the great honor of writing about D9 when I was a community reporter at the Union Tribune. It was one of my favorite districts to cover and write about because the communities were so diverse and the issues and stories they had to share were quite incredible. So I recently went to a debate where our two candidates debated and I heard a lot of concerns about housing, college parties, of course, parking at a library, homelessness, and public safety. So hopefully we get to elaborate on some of those conversations. Good. Okay. So I'll start with you, Sean. Earlier this week, I was watching a city council meeting, and you guys received an update on the city shelter beds. As we've reported, there are not enough beds available, not even for those who want them. And in June, you offered a series of steps, tools that the city could use to bring more shelters online. There were a lot of recommendations in that page, but I want to have you elaborate on one of them. One of them was eminent domain. As we reported, Mayor Todd Gloria didn't seem super thrilled about the idea, but can you explain why you view this as an opportunity, and maybe can you explain what eminent domain is?
Yes. Thank you, Andrea. Thank you, everyone, for being here. I appreciate the opportunity. So, as was mentioned, we obviously have a homelessness crisis, a housing crisis. We don't have enough shelter beds for the folks who want shelter. Despite what you may hear, more often than not, in fact, by a wide margin, when people seek shelter, they're not able to receive that shelter. That's unacceptable. Nobody here should be okay with people sleeping on the streets, especially when they are seeking shelter. So we put forward a memo with a number of recommendations in there, ranging from diversion from our shelter system with non-covered options. And one of those options was eminent domain. And eminent domain is a process along with what we refer to as friendly condemnation, where the government acquires property for fair market value because they see a critical need for that property and use for that property. Well, we're in an emergency. We have people sleeping on streets who should not be sleeping on streets. Our shelters are full. We have properties in District 9 and in other parts of the city that have been underutilized or poorly utilized for years, that have been magnets for crime and vandalism and negative activities that have hurt the neighborhoods for a long time. And in my mind, the idea of allowing a resource, a crucial resource like a hotel or a motel or other property to continue to be a negative for the community when we're in an emergency is unacceptable. And so I absolutely think that the city should be pursuing opportunities to engage with property owners, to turn those points of pain that are in our community into points of pride, where families and seniors can get the shelter, particularly non-congregate shelter that we know is so successful in getting people on a path, not just indoors, but on the path to permanent housing, which I think should be our goal for every single person who's experiencing homelessness in San Diego.
Do you see this as something that, you know, you could get buy-in from? I know the mayor kind of seemed not too interested.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to drop it because I think this is a values issue. Again, it is unacceptable to me that we have people sleeping on the streets who are seeking shelter. It's unacceptable to me that some of those people are seniors who have health issues and who the traditional congregate shelter setting is simply unacceptable to. People who cannot go indoors because they have incontinence issues or other health issues that don't allow them to move into a congregate setting either with the dignity that they deserve or the health needs that they have. So given that those are the stakes in my mind, I think we have a moral imperative to make the best use of property possible. And friendly condemnation and eminent domain is a tool that we can use to do that. It is also a tool, and the city attorney's office agreed with this, it's a tool that provides important leverage to the city in negotiating through our normal transactions. When we take that tool off the table and say that we aren't going to use it, that adds leverage to those property owners who might otherwise give a little bit more in their negotiations with the city.
Just a little background on that. When Sean released his memo, we reported on that memo and the mention of eminent domain, and the mayor's office did not seem interested in pursuing that option, which then the city attorney responded with her own thoughts that saying no to eminent domain so publicly was troublesome for current negotiations that have to do with the 1,000-bed shelter the mayor wants to open in Middletown.
If I could just add one other piece for context, within the few weeks prior to that, the recent release of that memo, the city had utilized eminent domain to acquire property for an important bike path to for part of our regional bike network. But a couple of those properties that we acquired through that process, the acquisitions happened in very short amount of time, in less than a year. And it wasn't our, you know, the more arduous eminent domain process that I think many people think about, which leads to, you know, time in court and trial. But instead, a property owner that said, oh, sure, I'd happily sell that. I've been looking to get this off my hands, or that seems like a fair price. We have to offer a fair price. And that property was able to transition in less than a calendar year. So knowing that we have a history of being able to execute in that amount of time was another reason why I offered that when I did.
Terry, you weighed in on Sean's memo, and you admitted that some, quote, may be practical, but you seem to take issue with others. Can you kind of explain what those were?
I can. Again, thank you, everyone, for coming. I really do appreciate it. And thank for San Diego's for hosting this. So our shelter dilemma did not just come up 2 or 3 months ago. Our council and our city has known about our dilemma with shelter beds for a long time. So acting like it's now an emergency, they should have done something 2 years ago or 3 years ago, not just now. One of the things with eminent domains, it affects to acquire property, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's supposed to have the possibility of affecting everyone, like a bike path. Anyone can use the bike path. Typically, they do it when they acquire land for highways, because the concept is anyone could use that. However, in this situation, it really doesn't apply to everyone. So I'm kind of against the strong hand of government, one, taking away rights from people, and then two, kind of imploring their rights when they don't have to. If this would have been looked at in a realistic manner last year, earlier on last year, where you had a year, 2 years to go, then they could have found these properties and negotiated without having to use the threat of, you know, an eminent domain. And from what I understand, part of the issue was, and I think the mayor said this, was, and it does take a long time to acquire property. I guess that depends upon, obviously, the owner of the property. But the incumbent said this was in an emergency. Well, at the moment, we're not in an emergency. We're in a crisis. But no one has said that San Diego is in an emergency. So I think at this point, we have not had a great history of purchasing properties. I mean, 101 Ash Street is a great example. We go out and we buy things really quickly, and then we're stuck with them. So I think, even if you bought property, it will take a while for it to get up and running, right? And I don't know if we have any plans inside homeless shelters. That's the thing. That's one of my biggest complaints with the city when they talk about a 1,000-bed shelter. You know, a great example, I'm like, well, okay, boom, you got the 1,000 beds. How's it going to work? Are you going to house men and women together? No, you have to separate them. How about couples? You have to separate them. LGBTQ+, you got to separate them. Transgender, you're going to have to separate them. What about people with animals? You're going to have to separate them. That has not been discussed. There is no plan afterwards. So my biggest thing, again, is that this just didn't happen this month, last month, the month before last. Everyone has known these timelines. And now, maybe because it's an election year, everyone's kind of come up with possibilities and probabilities and potentials how to solve it.
But I just ask a quick question. Terry, is your position that the general public does not benefit from homeless individuals receiving shelter?
Okay, so my opponent is trying to say that, that I'm totally against homelessness. And so I'm going to finish my thing. They do. Society does benefit. But you can't be hypocritical about how we approach this. So when the city passed the camp ban, the incumbent voted against it. But yet, at the same time, that's how he's moving people within the district from one side of the road to the other, by telling people, get it done. Another issue is that I'm not really convinced that shelter first is an option, is a viable option, and I don't think housing first is a viable option. I like to utilize Huntington Beach as a perfect role model, I think, for homelessness. And what they do is they have a very vibrant navigation center that's run by Mercy House. They really, if you look at their entire scheme, and I'm sure we're going to talk about it later, but they do it right. Again, I'm not for eminent domain. I don't think government should do that, especially when you had 2 years to plan for this. This just didn't happen.
To Terry's point, we knew that some of these shelters were going to close. Do you feel that the city was kind of slow to respond to that closure?
I think the city's been slow to respond to homelessness for decades. But I also think we've done a lot. So we have expanded shelter capacity. And this is one of the reasons why I am so committed to the prevention side of homelessness. Shelter is a band-aid. Shelter is not a permanent home. Nobody should live in shelter for the rest of their lives. And it should not be our end goal to simply get everyone who's on the streets into shelter. The end goal for the city should be to have everyone who's experiencing homelessness no longer be experiencing homelessness. So over the course of the last few years, we've expanded not just the number of beds, but the types of beds. We have converted hotels and motels into shelter, the non-congregate shelter. That's particularly, again, that is extremely helpful for families with children and seniors. That non-congregate setting is the most efficient for giving someone an opportunity to get their feet under them, get their life settled, get their business in order, so that they can get onto that path to permanent housing. We've done that. We have experience doing that. I championed that as soon as I got into office. It takes time for some of these things to come online. So we've expanded the types of shelter. Terry is absolutely right. We need different types of shelter for folks with different types of needs. So we've expanded those options. But we need to do more. And the memo that was put forward in June was, one, with recent news that beds would be going offline, and two, in anticipation of the consideration of the Kettner and Vine lease that was being proposed by the mayor. So the idea that I have not done anything or proposed anything is ludicrous. It either is a lie or a complete misunderstanding of the city civics over the last 3.5 years. There's been nobody who's offered more types of solutions than I have on council. I will say, to point to Huntington Beach as a model for anything that the city of San Diego should do is wild to me. I grew up in Huntington Beach. That is a city governed by ultra-right-wing conservatives. It is the Florida of California. And I mean that in the worst way possible. They are completely out of step with the rest of the state. They have had completely unprepared and radical people elected into office, including UFC fighters. It is a Trump city. And again, the idea that we would point to that as a model for how San Diego should follow is unacceptable to me, and I think should open a lot of eyes in this room.
So, Terry, may I respond?
Yes. You toured Huntington Beach.
I did twice.
And you saw what they were doing. What is it exactly that you felt, you know, could work here in San Diego?
Well, briefly, first of all, I don't lie. I didn't spend 26 years in the Marine Corps. Very successful, attainment rank of a sergeant major, the highest enlisted that I could become. 15 years with San Diego PD. I'm not on any Brady list. I don't lie on the stand, so I speak my mind. The incumbent can say what he wants, but he sent the memo out in June. We knew these beds were going offline way before June. So again, when the city acts slow, they did not, and they just didn't take proactive action in this. And now everything is kind of like, an emergency. And instead, they should have took action before. And if the mayor wasn't going to, then the council should have, which he is the leadership of. He controls everything that comes on the docket. And so this could have been brought up, and it was not. So you're right, Andrea. I did tour Huntington Beach, and I found, and I don't know anything about Huntington Beach, so unless he's a Trump supporter, I don't know why he keeps talking about Trump. But for me, in your newspaper, the North County Times,
Tigas,
wrote an article how some of the mayors of North County went to Huntington Beach to tour their facility. I read the piece, and I was pretty impressed, because it just didn't talk about the shelter side of it. It talked about the law enforcement side of it, how they've taken things completely off the plate for law enforcement. They have and I'll call it a rapid response team, but that's not it, of perp technicians that have been trained in de-escalation. And they'll give you, every year, if you just go on their website, look, a number something like 4,500 times this last year where law enforcement did not respond to a mental health crisis like we do here in San Diego. You know, law enforcement is a 911 for everything. You got to, you know, got something happening. If you don't know who to call, and typically it's 911 or the non-emergency number. So when I talk about how this model is successful, that's what it does. It talks about that. If you look at, and I don't know when the incumbent was last in Huntington Beach, but when I drove it, because I'm thinking, okay, I know what our shelters look like downtown, right? We know what downtown looks like. I'm thinking around the Opera Project, this it's going to look the same. It does not look the same. So I was very impressed. I talked with business owners around the shelter. There's no signage or anything about it. You can't walk up to it. There's little, they got like a little bus that takes people places. So you can drive if you have a car. You just can't ride your bike up. But they'll take you where you want to go with the shuttle. They got storage facilities. And another good thing that we do, and no one's talked about with our, you know, shelter facility, because we don't have a plan. I've talked to thousands of homeless people when I was a police officer. Thousands. I know what works. I know what doesn't work. I know what will entice somebody to take a shelter if they're addicted to something, or if they have mental illness, and I know things that won't work. So Huntington Beach has a very low barrier. So what I mean is they got things that we require you must have, they don't. Sobriety is one. If you have an addiction of anything, and they're trying to get you to a facility, and you can't be, and sobriety isn't, well, sobriety is a requirement, you're not going to take that, you're not going to go to that shelter. You're not going to take that program. So they have an extremely low barrier for sobriety. Doesn't mean you can't come in there under the influence. It just means you can't do it there. So they have an amnesty box. People come in, they drop alcohol off, they drop drugs off. Nothing's asked. They get fed, showered. They get inundated with services. They have food that's prepared for them. They even have a yoga room. I don't know what they need a yoga room, but they have a yoga room. When I was there, a person was actually relaxing and in his own little world, which was good. He was happy. And everyone in there that I spoke with was appreciative, because it wasn't like, well, you got to get off the street and then be clean all of a sudden, because that does not work. So having low barriers work. So when I talk about the homeless program they have with a very viable navigation system, you know, it's amazing. In other words, they got a huge partnership outside of City Hall. City Hall doesn't really govern what goes on in that shelter. right? So what they have is, let's say that Terry, who is unsheltered, and as the incumbent said, maybe only need $50 or $100 to keep his rent up. So they send out an email to all their partnerships, nonprofit, faith-based organizations, and for-profit, and they say, I have an individual unsheltered named Terry. All he needs is $100 to keep his rent. Somebody in that partnership picks up Terry. So I'm not talking about the municipal side of Huntington Beach. I'm speaking merely to the homeless crisis and how they approached it. So for someone to sit there and just without even looking at it, I think it says a lot about, hope it opens your eyes.
I think a lot of the discussion about shelter, we have been writing about how people want shelter and they often can't secure a bed or try several times before they can get a bed. Now, this conversation has really come to the forefront since the city of San Diego did adopt an unsafe camping ban, which prevented people from camping on the street at all times in certain places, like near schools and near shelters, and then at all times, or at times if there is shelter available. Now, Terry, at a recent debate, you said that you didn't necessarily think that, you know, police should like go around and arrest people related to the camping ban, but you mentioned that you believed in nudging.
Yes.
What is nudging to you?
So, you know, if there's rules on the books where it talks about that, like must pass by the city, or camping ban is, where camping is prohibited. So the progressive, how we deal with it now is in a progressive manner. So if me as a law enforcement officer contact Terry, who's unsheltered, the first time is communication. It's just talking. It's like they classify it as education. The next time we'll do a field interview. Again, it's just education, but it's documented for sure this time. Next time may be a citation. Next time it could be a misdemeanor arrest. It depends what the totality of the situation is. But if I move two blocks down and begin another encampment, that process starts all over again. So what you and I see mostly on the streets are the really homeless that are really addicted to stuff, whether it's mental illness, whether it's some type of controlled substance or alcohol. You know, they all went through trauma to be where they're at. They don't have trust. They don't have a lot of things. So it's financially unstable for us to continue moving encampments from one side of the street to the other. We're sending ESD to go clean up it, and then the next day it's right back, and 2 weeks later it's the same. You see it, and I see it. So nudging is a way that we take enforcement action, right? And you say, you're criminalizing homelessness. I'm not. Because one of the things that, you know, and one of the other, I think, classes or discussions is on Prop 47 and that kind of stuff. What Prop 47 did, to just briefly go through it, it prevented people from getting in drug court for a long time. So in other words, if Terry was a heroin addict and police officer contacted me for whatever reason, it was legal, I had it on me, possession, it would be a felony book into jail. Everyone knows that those felonies got moved down to, because you're a wobbler, right? So you can book it as a felony, but it normally gets prosecuted as a wobbler. So, but what it did was it got me into the system where on my way out, the judge would give me drug court. It put me into the system. So what Prop 47 did, it alleviated all that. So I do believe in nudging. Absolutely. I think you have to, you know, we talk about quality of life. It's not quality of life for the residents or for the unsheltered to have them live like they live. It's just not. I've arrested some. I made great friends with some. I watched some die. A quick little story of a little African-American lady in Rolando and Rolando Park. I've known this lady for years. Years. So one day, I go, I'm not going to tell you anything, but that's all right. But I'll say, what I tell you all the time? She goes, Officer Terry, you tell me you care more about me than I do about myself. And I would say, yes, I do. And then one day we're talking, and she goes, my mom only lives like a mile away in District 9. I'm like, you're kidding me. She's like, no. And I go, well, how come I don't know that? She goes, I don't know. You're the cop. And I go, fair enough. So I took a selfie of her with me. I went to the house, knocked on the door. Now, just picture this for what you have you want to picture. The lady came to the door. I'm in uniform. What do you want? I said, hey, I'm Officer Terry. I'm looking for the family of so-and-so. What has she done? She hasn't done anything. Why are you here? I said, well, I've talked with your daughter for years, and I just now realize that her parents live here. So I wanted to see if there's anything I could do in conjunction with you to get her off the streets, because I'm worried about her welfare. She comes outside her house crying. She said, of all the time law enforcement has came to her house about her daughter, this is the first time a law enforcement officer walked up to her house saying, I want to work with you to get my daughter off the street. So we talked like an hour. And I'm almost done. We talked for like an hour. I took a selfie of her, of us together, went back to the young lady that's on the street. And now she didn't come back off. She didn't leave the streets. But it reinforced the fact that you can't treat all homeless people the same. It's not a cookie cutter environment. And that's what people think it is. It's a cookie cutter. So nudging. You have to be able to nudge people for your quality of life and for theirs. I apologize for being long.
Sean, you voted against the camping ban. Have your feelings changed?
No. It was a tense meeting. But what I thought then and what I remember and have seen nothing to change my mind about is that there are no experts in this field who believe that law, as written, was going to reduce homelessness in San Diego. It was going to move where homelessness is in San Diego, but it was not going to reduce it. And I appreciate the story that Terry just told. I think that there needs to be more of that. I think it is tragic that is the first time that that sort of interaction with that younger woman's family had happened in that way. The system should be built in such a way where that is the first place we can look for folks who are experiencing homelessness is to, you know, friends and family to see if there are ways to connect them with housing. And clearly, if that's the first time that happened, the system is not built in that way. The ban, I opposed for a number of reasons. One, I did not think, as the Constitution was currently being interpreted at that point in time by the Supreme Court, before the radical right-wing Supreme Court overturned, changed the law with respect to homelessness, that it would be upheld in the courts. I was sad that it did, that it was upheld. Two, I thought it was setting unrealistic expectations for the community as to what they would see as a result. And three, I thought there would be huge implications for neighborhoods that weren't going to be as high up on the priority list. We did not have the resources to, even if you think the ban is a good idea, we do not have the resources to enforce that equally across the city. And if you can't enforce that equally across the city, you should ask yourself, then where will folks end up? Where are we trying to push them from? And where are they most likely to end up as a result? And we knew in District 9, previous experiences, that crackdowns on homelessness in downtown led to increased homelessness, street homelessness in District 9, in areas that did not have any of the social services or facilities to help those folks get back on their feet. That also did not receive the same sort of attention from the city, meaning that the impacts were not just more heavily felt, but longer felt as well. That trash that ended up on the sidewalk or in a canyon stayed there longer. So it was a bad deal for District 9. Zero experts in the field of homelessness showed up to speak in support of it. I tried to be guided by research and expertise. And I do not think that the expectations that were set were going to be able to be met by the city. I've studied homelessness since I was a law student. I have my own personal experiences with it. And never, I need to understand what nudging is. I understand it as a concept. We either have a ban or we don't. We either are going to enforce the ban or we're not going to.
You would enforce it.
So you're supportive of the ban?
Yes,
okay.
Absolutely.
Because it's gotten fuzzy the last couple of days.
Shouldn't have.
Okay.
Sean, earlier you...
May I say one more thing? Yeah. So, you know, it's easy to sit here and say that you don't agree with, you know, the Supreme Court and all the other stuff. That's fine. Well, that's not my wheelhouse, right? My wheelhouse is to do what people tell us that we can do. I mean, I'm not in law enforcement anymore, but at that time. It's funny that when the mayor said this was going to be the policy of the city, and now you got the governor who has also stated the same. So I don't think it's so far-fetched to say that everybody is kind of tired of the status quo that's been going on, because it hasn't worked. It has not worked.
Yeah, I think that's a false choice. The idea that the only options in front of this city are that ordinance is passed or the status quo and letting things persist as they were is an absolutely false choice. There are a multitude of...
What are they?
Getting there.
Okay.
Yeah. So again, prevention, knowing that 85% of people who experience homelessness begin that experience as a result of financial circumstances.
People you see out on the street, Sean, is not like that. The people you see that are in encampments, that are extremely fortified, it's not that. That's not why they're there, Sean.
Okay.
So they know
Terry's got his opinion, and then there could be there's a statewide study of thousands of individuals who are experiencing homelessness, and everyone who's researched this. 85% of people become homeless. That's not meaning why they're homeless today, right? I don't know about anybody else in this room, but personally, My physical and mental health would not hold up so well if I was living on the streets. I know that from personal experience. I know that from common sense. So the idea that there isn't some sort of degrading that happens to a person's physical and mental ability while they're living on the streets, that defies common sense. 85% of people become homeless for financial reasons. The fastest growing group of people who are becoming homeless are seniors. That means people on fixed incomes who cannot keep up with the cost of living. Maybe I'm missing something. I have not heard about the senior drug epidemic that has taken over our boomer generation.
Well, it's funny to be comical about...
No, I'm not being comical
about it.
No, I'm being dead serious about this because deadly serious issue.
It is.
The best way to get ahead on homelessness is through prevention. The city council, which I led and lead, put forward in the budget funding for a prevention program that has incredible success. We've pushed harder and harder and harder to put more funding in that. I've worked with philanthropy to establish additional programs for seniors to keep them in their homes. That's the way we get ahead. On a monthly basis, San Diego over the last 2 years has housed anywhere in the range between 700 and 1,200 people per month who are experiencing homelessness. That means they exit homelessness and enter permanent housing. Every single month, we've had more people fall into homelessness. The problem is not that we don't know how to get people off the streets. The problem is not that we don't know how to get people out of shelter. The problem is that we don't know how to keep them off the streets. And we will not do that in any effective way whatsoever if we are only willing to respond to the worst version of the problem that we see in front of us instead of actually thinking a few steps ahead and trying to prevent it. It is preventable. I will never accept that in the richest country in the world, in one of the wealthiest cities in the richest country in the world, that homelessness is an inevitable fact that we have to accept. I will not accept that.
Well, there are reasons that you and I differ, and obviously this is one of them. But when you talk about the elderly, you know, why don't we get with their tenants and say, let's come up with the lady that I talked about this with, and so we called it the McCann-Hoskins Pact, where you get with the tenant where you have elderly living and say, we're going to establish a 10-year lease. We're going to give you tax credits so that you don't raise your rent on the elderly.
Terry, we passed a tenant protection ordinance, which you opposed, mm-hmm. which had additional protections for seniors. And again, we've established homelessness prevention programs for seniors. These are actual policies that we passed and programs we put in place.
And they work.
So they are working. We need to invest in them more.
Yeah. And by the way, talking about numbers and getting housed, what they don't tell you is the reason why the numbers are high because they get unhoused. They get into housing, and if they're not in the proper services that they need, they leave. And then all of a sudden, they're back out on the street, and it's like it's just a revolving door.
Thank you for introducing housing, Terry, because we're not going to solve the homelessness crisis here today, unfortunately. Sean, there was a city council meeting, again, that I was watching. You guys. I don't normally, so don't feel bad for me. I was just prepping for this session. But you said that the housing conversation is complex. There is the financing and the permitting side. And when you guys were provided an annual report on homes, you said this. There's a lot of interest. This was in response to what your fellow council members were saying. There's a lot of interest in seeing more affordable development happen. And that won't happen without an investment on our end. What investment do you see is missing?
Well, at the largest scale, I believe in social housing. And I don't see a way out of California's housing crisis or the American housing crisis without massive public investment in housing. That means the public building housing, utilizing social housing model where we have mixed income developments that provide housing opportunities for people up and down the income ladder, dignified housing that receives the same sort of respect that any of our neighborhoods receive. So that's what I am advocating for at the federal and state levels. I'm a big supporter of that. Until we get there, we need local dedicated revenue. In the short term, the city is putting money toward affordable housing, like providing loans, providing grants to get that done. The city's, through the city council's leadership as the housing authority, the housing commission has secured hundreds of millions of dollars for what we call Project Home Key, which is the conversion of motels and hotels into permanent housing for folks. We've done that actually quite successfully over the last couple cycles. It's investments like that. But ultimately, we are going to need ongoing dedicated revenue, which will provide the builders, whether that means the Housing Commission or other builders in our community, the knowledge to know that there will be funding there for them to tap into to build what they need. Right now, as I mentioned before, we have a public need, a basic human right in housing that is almost solely dependent on private funding. And not just private for-profit funding. And that model is breaking our society. We are living in a city where fewer and fewer people are being able to see themselves having a future here, where young families are having to face the decision of whether or not they should stay in the city that they love or have to move out of state, where our college students, with less and less and less certainty, more and more uncertainty, are graduating with nothing more than a hope that they'll be able to continue to live here. And so that seems like a very, very good reason for us to have local dedicated revenue to invest in more affordable housing to supplement the market rate that is being built.
When you talk about public housing, you mean like the city seeking out funds from other, like from the federal government?
I think that would be, it'd be a combination of funds, the sources that could be, and that's part of some of the policies that need to change at the federal and state level would allow us to cobble those together so the public could actually build the housing, right? So there's publicly owned, there's publicly financed, right? Those are different things, and I'm for both.
So if I may just quickly. So as a councilman, you got to be inclusive. You got to have, you're at it, your ability to work within your district has to include everyone, right? So keep that in mind. You can't be divider and separate group. You got to focus on everyone together.